It's already been touched on. But as you know, we've been reading from the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 5, for the last few Sundays. A couple Sundays ago was the Beatitudes. Last Sunday was you are the salt of the earth, you are the light of the world. And this week, this is a little sticky. And there is definitely a discipline to preaching from the lectionary, not picking what I want to preach on, but preaching on what the calendar gives me. So because this one is kind of a long passage, I wanted to split it up with Bruce, but I also invite you to follow along. If you find a pew row Bible near where you are, it's blue, and you turn to the New Testament section, it's page 4 where we begin, pages 4 and 5. But if you have your phone or your iPad out with you, feel free to get that out. BibleGateway.com is a good one to check. Matthew chapter 5, and we will start with verse 21. And then we'll move to the end of the chapter. So let's listen for God's wisdom and word. Here I start. Hear the teachings of Jesus from Matthew chapter 5.
It says you.
I'm the reader. Okay, cool. Reader 2. You have heard that it was said to those of ancient times, you shall not murder, and whoever murders shall be liable to judgment. But I say to you that if you are angry with a sibling, you will be liable to judgment. And if you insult a sibling, you will be liable to the council. And if you say, you fool, you will be liable to the hell of fire. So when you are offering your gift at the altar, if you remember that your sibling has something against you, leave your gift there before the altar and go. First be reconciled to your sibling and then come and offer your gift. Come to terms quickly with your accuser while you accompany them to court. Or your accuser may hand you over to the judge, and the judge to the guard, and you will be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you will never get out until you have paid the last penny.
You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that anyone who looks at a person with lust has already committed adultery with them in their heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one of your members than for your whole body to go into hell.
It was also said, whoever divorces their spouse, let them give a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that anyone who divorces their spouse, except on the grounds of unchastity, causes them to commit adultery. And whoever marries a divorced person commits adultery.
Again, you've heard it said that it was said in those ancient times, you shall not swear falsely, but carry out the vows you have made to the Eternal One. But I say to you, do not swear at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by earth, for it is God's footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great ruler. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make one hair black or white. Let your word be yes, yes, or no, no. Anything more comes from the evil one.
And I'm going to keep going back past what we were supposed to read. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for the tooth. But I say to you, do not resist an evildoer. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your coat, give your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go also the second mile. Give to everyone who begs from you, and do not refuse anyone who wants to borrow from you. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be children of your Father and Mother in heaven. For God makes the sun to shine on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the righteous and on the unrighteous. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your siblings, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father, your heavenly Mother is perfect. This is holy wisdom, holy word. Thanks be to God. Thank you, Bruce. Now, we read this passage at midweek manna in the chapel on Wednesday morning, and I said, kind of tongue-in-cheek, holy wisdom, holy word. And someone said, if you say so. And right before worship, Bruce kind of said, this is a doozy. And so I'm really glad that I have a lawyer to help me nuance this. And he said, I don't think there's any nuance to this. This is a kind of an Old Testament thing. This is a really difficult passage. And I want, if you still have your Bible open or your phone out, keep following along with me because I really want to spend some time unpacking what we've just heard. First of all, the you to whom Jesus is addressing this is a plural you. If you're from the South, you would say y'all. Jesus is addressing the same audience as he was addressing in the rest of the Sermon on the Mount, the same audience that received the Beatitudes, blessed are the poor, blessed are the mourn, blessed are the peacemakers. It's the same group of people he's talking to, those who are downtrodden and marginalized. And he's also speaking to that group, that motley crew of disciples that he'd recruited, the fisher people, the tax collectors, the rest. And you can consider this Sermon on the Mount, which ranges from chapters 5-7, as Jesus' inaugural sermon for this new community that he's trying to build. And what he's doing in this, he's not negating the law. He's talking about the Torah and the Ten Commandments, the law of Moses, and talking about the prophets. And people are wanting to know, what is his relationship to these things? Is he trying to come up with a brand new thing, or is he revising an old? And Jesus says, I have come not to abolish the law and the prophets, but to fulfill them. So you can think that Jesus is taking this law of Moses that people are already pretty well versed in, and he's amplifying or intensifying the commandments. And Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew's whole project is really about righteousness. Now that's a kind of a loaded word for us, but I think justice might be a better word. He's trying to show what it looks like in the life of Jesus, what living out of God's will, what living rightly and what living justly looks like. So we have this amplified Ten Commandments, you could think of it that way. How many people, when you read or heard this, bristled a little? That's it? Okay. But, I mean, this really is pretty strident language, and I want to spend some time unpacking it. Richard Rohr, who many of you are familiar with, he's an author, he's a priest and a monk up in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And back in the 90s, he wrote a book called Jesus' Plan for a New World, The Sermon on the Mount. And Richard Rohr, as he tends to do, really is able to drill down to the heart of these passages that seem kind of difficult and bring the life out of them. And he talks about how, I love the way he phrases this, you have heard it said, but the real problem is. You have heard it said, but the real problem is. And I'll go through a couple of these. Let's talk about the you shall not murder. You have heard it said, you shall not murder, but the problem is you still nurse anger and accusation. And then he offers a solution, or he identifies a solution that Jesus puts forth, and that is go be reconciled. Go and say you're sorry before you go to church. You have heard it said, now this one's the really sticky one. You have heard it said, don't commit adultery. But I say the real problem is fantasy and lustful looking continue. Does anybody, if you were alive then, remember when Jimmy Carter talked about lusting in his heart? I believe he was the first presidential candidate to be interviewed by Playboy magazine, I think it was. Almost cost him the election. But what he was saying was that he had lusted in his heart and therefore committed adultery. And people found that level of honesty a little off-putting, I think. In the version I read, it was a little gender inclusive. But if you look at the original text about this teaching on adultery, Jesus is addressing men. He says, whatever man divorces his wife, except on the grounds of adultery, it's not valid. This is a really difficult verse for us to hear in a culture where many people are married 2, 3, and more times. And it's inevitably awkward to read this in church, knowing that many of us are divorced, and many of us come from families that are multiple combinations. The thing that they really notice here is that Jesus is, as I said, addressing men. And back in that day and time, what were to happen if a woman was divorced? She would be thrown out on the street. She would be left destitute. She would have no one to care for her, because back then, many women did not own property. They did not have jobs. They were illiterate. So for a man to dismiss a woman and to just hand her that certificate of divorce and to just show her the paperwork, that would leave her in very vulnerable circumstances. So Jesus is saying to the men, it's not simply enough to fill out the paperwork, but you have to think about the impact of your actions. And Jesus not only says that about divorce, but he takes it a step further and talks about that lusting in the heart. And how I understand that these days, from the gift of so many feminist thinkers who have taught us about the gaze of men and what the gaze of men, the damage that it does to women. Or you can think about what some writers have talked about, the white gaze, the way that people of privilege have of looking at a situation and bringing their own privilege to it and thereby objectifying someone in the process. The writer Toni Morrison wrote a lot about the white gaze, or how she tried to avoid that in her literature. The way that we think of people, the way that our internal dispositions are directed toward people, makes as much of a difference as our external behavior. Richard Rohr, also, he says, you've heard it said, do not take oaths. But the real problem is, legal swearing only binds you into loyalty systems and mistrust. As Bailey invited us to imagine what the whole world would look like if people said they were sorry more, can you imagine if we trusted one another enough to receive our words as true? If our yes was yes and our no was no, if we didn't have to read the fine print in our interactions with one another, how deeply transformative would that be? Richard also talks about, you've heard it said, eye for an eye morality is justice, but the real problem is de facto vengeance and violent resistance. I think that one is not one we have to really spend much time exploring. The damage that retribution plays, not just on a world scale, not just in terms of violent conflicts, but in the way that we strike back at one another, and the ways that we strike back continue those awful, vicious cycles of violence. Rohr also talks about, you've heard it said, love your family and hate your enemy, but the real problem is this gets us nowhere, and it keeps our love small. I mean, how easy is it for us to care for those that we love, to look after those we love and we know and who are familiar to us, versus doing the hard work of loving those we perceive as enemy? See, what Jesus is doing here, he is trying to establish a new community. He's gathered these people around himself and he's taught them some things and he's healed some diseases and he's pronounced his blessings on them. And what he's doing, he's trying to say, this is the way that you should live. As a community that is trying to embody the reign of God, you should speak honestly, you should watch your words, you should behave toward people, you should watch your internal disposition toward them, because God sees what's in your heart and how what's in your heart eventually takes on flesh. Now, I think the way that Jesus begins here is really, he's speaking in a lot of hyperbole, because he's talking to people who, in their observance of rules, do a lot of checking off the box. Like, I haven't committed adultery. Check. I have not murdered anyone lately. Check. Going off and just meeting the bare minimum of requirements. But what Jesus is saying is, yes, here is the requirements of the law, but I tell you to go here. Broaden your love, broaden your understanding, broaden your compassion and mercy past those limits that are so human. And he says basically, and he has to shock us out of our intuitive ways of doing things so that we can begin to embrace this new way of living as a community of his disciples. A former pastor of mine, Joanna Adams, told a story that someone had emailed to her. She was a pastor in Chicago for a while. And she said that this one driver was at a stoplight, and the person in front of them wasn't going, you know, even though the stoplight was green. So the person was still there, and then she began to honk her horn, and the person, we'll say it's in this day and time, and they were looking at their phones. And she was laying on the horn, and the person wasn't moving, and she just started to scream, started to bang on the steering wheel, probably was offering some choice gestures from her hands. And then finally, the light turns yellow, and the person goes, and she is just stuck at the light. And she is furious, and she continues to bang on the wheel, and next thing you know, an officer knocks on the glass, and he says, "Ma'am, you're under arrest." Takes the woman downtown, processes her for booking, and she's in a holding cell for a while. And while she's in the holding cell, she's getting madder and madder, and this officer comes back and says, "I'm sorry, ma'am, but there's been a mistake. You see, I saw the silver Jesus fish on your bumper. I saw the bumper sticker, 'Follow me to Sunday school.' And I thought, clearly this car has been stolen." But she tells that story, and we laugh because we know all too well the gap between how Christians aspire to live and the kind of people they purport to be and then the kind of people we actually are. We know, at least on some gut level, that the church is called to be a different kind of community, that we have to do hard things like tell the truth and say that we're sorry and reconcile ourselves to those from whom we are separate. We have to do the hard work of thinking not only about the checklist of things that we do to live as decent people, but that we have to go that extra mile in loving our enemies and even praying for those who irritate the ever-living stew out of us. This is not an easy way to live, and we know that for most of human history, it seems like Jesus' followers have not done a very good job of being an alternate community to the ways of the world. But the one thing we're promised is that we are never left alone, that we can do this, that this is possible, not because who we are, but because of who God is. And you think how urgent it is for us to be an alternative, how urgent it is for there to be some other option of a way to do community. When even in this culture, from the very top, where words are cruel and they're vindictive and they're toxic, when bullying behavior is the norm at the top of the pyramid and filters down even into our schools, when you cannot trust the words that come out of people's mouths, that we have to have so many elaborate systems of enforcing the veracity of what it is we say, when an eye for an eye isn't just something we do interpersonally, but it's really the way the world is structured. How important is it for there to be an alternative for human life, for people to, in their own individual lives, but especially as a community, live and embody that a different way is possible? Jesus gives us these pretty strident comments. But I think it's because we need help being shaken out of our complacency in realizing the depth and the breadth of our responsibility to one another as those who try to follow Jesus. The famous preacher Fred Craddock once said toward the end of his life, "When I was young, I wanted to be a really good preacher. But as I get older, I just want to be a good Christian. To live simply, to speak truthfully, to love generously, and to leave the rest to God." May it be so.